Hello and welcome to this Microsoft TechNet session on SQL Server 2005 security. My name is Joel Barker. Here is what we're going to cover today. As we begin this session, we'll learn about how SQL Server 2005 breaks security down into a number of distinct areas. Also, throughout this session, you'll be introduced to security concepts that are new to SQL Server 2005, such as user schema separation. You'll also see how SQL Server 2005 implements current security concepts like encryption in ways that are new to this release. We'll look at security from the perspective of the server, the database, and database objects, and some of the different options you can use at each level to help secure your data. Finally, we'll take a look at how you can monitor the security of your SQL Server. By the end of the session, you'll understand how SQL Server 2005 gives you several different ways to help keep your enterprise data secure. As we go through today's session, you will hear various Microsoft acronyms and terminology. While we will explain all new terms related to today's session, there are some general terms from the industry or other versions of Microsoft products that we may not spend time on. To help you out, we have listed out the areas that it might be helpful to be familiar with either prior to this session or to reference afterwards. You should have experience with Windows Server 2003 or Windows Storage Server 2003. You should also have experience with the current or prior versions of Microsoft SQL Server or another relational database management system. You should also have some familiarity with security concepts such as permission schemes and encryption methods. Now let's look at the agenda for this session. We'll begin the session by talking about some of the security features available at the server level. SQL Server 2005 takes a multi-level approach to securing your enterprise data. After we look at security at the server level, we'll take a look at database-level security. Applications and users need to be able to easily gain access to the data they need without having extra privileges, and SQL Server 2005 gives you a number of ways to help keep your databases both available and secure. Once we've talked about SQL Server security at the database level, we'll take a closer look at how permissions work. With granular permissions and user schema separation, you can fine-tune exactly what permissions your users and applications have on database objects. Finally, we'll talk about how you can monitor the security of your SQL Server. Once you've secured your server and databases, you need to monitor security to help ensure your enterprise data stays secure, and SQL Server 2005 gives you the tools to do that. Security in SQL Server 2005 has several facets. Let's look at the different facets of security in SQL Server. First, SQL Server integrates into your existing Windows Server 2003 environment, so it receives the benefits of your domain security policies when using Windows authentication. The next layer of security occurs at the level of SQL Server itself. You can control how clients can connect to your SQL Server by enabling or disabling server services, features, and protocols. You can also encrypt communications between the SQL Server and clients. If you use mixed-mode authentication, a new security feature of SQL Server 2005 allows you to require your SQL-authenticated logins to have the same password complexity and expiration policies as your Active Directory environment, helping to ensure that SQL login passwords are strong. At the database level, schemas are used as virtual containers for database objects, including tables, views, and stored procedures. Users are assigned ownership of schemas instead of direct ownership of objects, helping to protect your data and enabling you to drop users without affecting your database applications. System tables are protected from modification by the use of catalog views, which expose system table data as needed with the minimum of permissions. The ability to monitor security on your SQL Server is vital, and SQL Server 2005 gives you the right tools to do it. One way SQL Server 2005 helps you to monitor security is by introducing data definition language, or DDL, triggers, which can trigger a notification when a database alteration occurs. Now, let's look at SQL Server level security more in depth. SQL Server 2005 is designed with the secure by default principle. When you install SQL Server 2005, only the minimal set of services, features, and connectivity options are enabled. All other features are off by default, so that you can minimize exposure of your server and databases and enable services and features only as you need them. With SQL Server 2005, you can use encryption to help secure your data. At the server level, SQL Server 2005 encryption uses the service master key, which you can create when you install SQL Server 2005. The service master key is protected through the Data Protection API, or DP API. You can use T-SQL statements to back up the service master key to a file for recovery purposes. SQL Server 2005 supports HTTP endpoints, services that listen for HTTP requests natively on the SQL Server. Using HTTP endpoints with SQL Server 2005 allows you to expose stored procedures or user-defined functions to web applications without installing Internet Information Services on your SQL Server. The Surface Area Configuration Manager is a new security tool for managing your SQL Server 2005 installations. With the Surface Area Configuration Manager, you can see the status of services and features on your SQL Server and enable them or disable them as you need. SQL Server 2005 also includes a command line utility, sac.exe, that you can use to import and export Surface Area Configuration settings to several SQL Servers at once without having to set each SQL Server individually with the GUI tool. Let's learn more about the secure by default concept. Now we'll take a look at how the secure by default principle works for fresh installations of SQL Server 2005, as well as for upgrades from SQL Server 2000. Here we're installing SQL Server 2005 on a Windows Server 2003 system as a fresh install. When the installation is complete, the SQL Server has a minimum of necessary services and features enabled by default. The SQL Server will allow connections from the local system only, so that we keep the server safe from the network connections until we're ready to enable them. We can use the Surface Area Configuration Manager tool to enable other services and features, or we can use the command line sac.exe tool to import server-level security configuration settings from another server. Now we're going to upgrade a SQL Server 2000 installation to SQL Server 2005. When an upgrade is performed, the upgrade process preserves all your network, service, and feature settings, but does not enable any new features or services. As with the fresh install, once the upgrade is complete, you can use the Surface Area Configuration Manager, or sac.exe, to enable or disable services and features as necessary to provide the best level of security for your SQL Server 2005 installation. Now we'll look at this in the first demonstration. Here we'll look at how to configure some of the new server-level security features. One of the new security tools in SQL Server 2005 is the Surface Area Configuration tool. The Surface Area Configuration tool allows you to manage a number of different aspects of SQL Server so that you can turn on only the options and features you need for your SQL Server instance. The Surface Area Configuration tool is divided into two major sections, Services and Connections, and Features. First, we'll look at the Surface Area Configuration for Services and Connections. This utility provides a single interface where you can manage the status of all SQL Server-related services, as well as enabling and disabling network connection options. Disabling unused services and connections helps protect your server by reducing the surface area. By default, SQL Server 2005 allows only local connections, in keeping with the off-by-default principle. However, Since this installation is an upgrade from SQL Server 2000, the upgrade preserved the settings for the original installation, which allows both local and remote connections using TCP/IP. Next, we'll look at the status of the MSFTE SQL service, which runs the full-text search service. The service area configuration tool advises you to disable the service unless your database applications need it. On this instance, the service is enabled and currently running. For this SQL Server instance, we don't need full-text searching, so we'll stop the service and set its status to disabled so that it won't start automatically in the future. The surface area configuration lets you view services and network configuration grouped by instance or grouped by component type. This makes getting security by four SQL servers with several instances more convenient. The surface area configuration tool for features allows you to enable and disable specific features as your SQL Server instance and applications need. You should disable features that you don't need to help reduce the exposed surface area of your installation. As before, you can see what setting the surface area configuration tool recommends for your server and how enabling or disabling a feature affects the SQL Server instance. For example, ad hoc remote queries, which allow ad hoc queries to be run against remote sources without linked or remote servers, are disabled by default because they can pose a security risk. The dedicated administrator connection allows you to connect to a SQL server even if the server isn't responding to regular connections. For security reasons, DAC is disabled by default. If you manage multiple SQL Server installations from a remote computer, you may want to enable this. The Surface Area Configuration for Features tool allows you to view configuration options grouped by the type of feature instead of by instance for convenience when managing servers with multiple instances. Next, we'll take a look at how SQL Server 2005 separates users and schema for additional security. SQL Server 2005 encrypts all login packets by default so that usernames and passwords are not transmitted across the network in clear text. But you can also have the SQL Server encrypt all communications between the server and client, helping protect sensitive data or information about your database infrastructure from being transmitted across the network in clear text. We're going to configure our SQL Server here to encrypt all traffic. Because traffic encryption occurs at the server level, its configuration is set in the SQL Server Configuration Manager tool. Encryption is a top-level setting for the protocol so that no matter what protocol your clients use to communicate with SQL Server, the traffic is encrypted. On the Flags tab, you can specify whether or not the SQL Server should force the traffic encryption, and you can also specify that an instance can be hidden so that the name of the instance will not be advertised to clients over the network. Clients must know the name of the instance in order to connect to it. When using encryption, you have the option to specify a certificate that will be used for encryption and server authentication. You may use a certificate issued by an external certificate authority such as VeriSign, or you may use a certificate issued by a Windows Server 2003 certificate authority if you have installed your own root CA. However, you can also leave the certificate settings blank. In this case, SQL Server 2005 will create a self-signed certificate for encryption when the SQL Server service is started. We're going to use this method on our server. Once you've chosen a certificate, or if you want to let SQL Server issue its own certificate, all you need to do is set the Force Encryption field to Yes and save the changes. Now that you've set the server to encrypt network traffic, we need to restart the SQL service. We'll return to the SQL Server Management Studio to make our first encrypted connection to the SQL Server. Because the SQL Server requests the encryption, we don't have to make any changes in client software to have our traffic encrypted. When connected to SQL Server over an encrypted connection, there is no indication that your connection to the server is encrypted. However, you can use the Network Monitor tool in Windows Server 2003 to verify that your traffic is encrypted. First, we'll look at a capture mode made with Network Monitor showing what traffic looks like before encryption is set at the server level. If you look closely at the decoded packets, you can see a significant amount of clear text information embedded in the packets. A hacker could use a small number of packets to gain important data or infrastructure information by sniffing unencrypted packets. Next, we'll look at a capture made after encryption was enabled on the SQL Server. If we look at the traffic here, we can find no plain text information transmitted across the network. All of our network traffic is encrypted, helping to secure our data from network sniffers. Another new feature of SQL Server 2005 is HTTP endpoints. HTTP endpoints can be used to expose data through functions or stored procedures over an HTTP connection. This allows database applications to use database programmability features over HTTP connections while exposing only the specific data returned by the function or stored procedure used to create the endpoint. Using HTTP endpoints in SQL Server 2005 does not require IIS to be installed on the SQL Server, so you can enhance your SQL Server security by separating your IIS servers from your SQL servers while still making databases available over HTTP. Even though HTTP endpoints expose data, they are created and managed at the server level. The SQL script here will expose information returned by the Get Employee Manager's stored procedure through an HTTP endpoint. Now that we've created the endpoint, any application that can submit and retrieve information through HTTP can get information from the endpoint. We'll verify our endpoint is working correctly by connecting to the endpoint using Internet Explorer. We can't interact with the endpoint without an application, but we can use Internet Explorer to retrieve the XML data description of the endpoint in the browser. A simple HTTP connection through Internet Explorer returns XML data about the endpoint, so we can see that the endpoint is working, exposing the data from the stored procedure for applications to use. Now that we've taken a look at server-level security, let's see what's next on the agenda. During this portion of the session, we'll look at how SQL Server 2005 gives you more security at the database level. One of the most important concepts in SQL Server 2005 is the schema. In SQL Server 2005, a schema is a container for database objects. The schema in which an object is defined is also part of the object namespace. The object namespace no longer includes object owners as it did in previous releases, providing greater flexibility when organizing database objects. A permission granted on a schema is inherited by the database objects within the schema. If necessary, permissions can be explicitly assigned to the schema scope and also to the object itself. For example, you could grant select permission on the schema and deny select permission on a specific table within the schema. The result is that the user has select permission on all objects in the schema except the table on which you denied select permission. However, if a user is denied access to the schema scope, you cannot access any objects that are members of the schema. Now that we've learned a little bit about schemas, let's see how users and schemas are separated in the SQL Server 2005. In previous versions of SQL Server, the object namespace included the object owner's name. As a result, database administrators and developers would write requests and code using the object owner's name as part of the query. This setup would cause major problems when you needed to transfer the ownership of the object to another security principal. You would need to rewrite any application that contained a reference to this object. SQL Server 2005 eliminates this problem by using a schema in place of the object owner. You can now change the object owner without affecting the path to the database object. Now we'll talk about encryption at the database level. At the database level, you have a number of different methods for encrypting data in SQL Server 2005. The simplest encryption method available is symmetric encryption. Symmetric encryption relies on a single shared key, a password that both encrypts and decrypts the data. Symmetric encryption is very fast, so it can be used for large amounts of data. Symmetric encryption, however, cannot be used to sign modules. If you need more security than symmetric encryption provides with its single shared key, you can use asymmetric encryption. With asymmetric encryption, each individual has their own public-private key pair for data encryption and decryption. Asymmetric encryption is more resource-intensive and somewhat slower than symmetric encryption. If you plan to distribute signed modules of your database application, you'll need to use asymmetric encryption with a certificate to verify the authenticity of the module. SQL Server 2005 includes its own certificate authority so that you can create, issue, and revoke certificates without having to use certificate services for the operating system or a third-party solution. Certificates can be used to verify the authenticity of encryption keys and can also be used to sign modules so that users of your web applications can be certain that the database application is authentic and has not been tampered with. Now we'll break from the presentation for the next demonstration. In this demonstration, we'll look at some of the database level security features of SQL Server 2005. SQL Server 2005 protects all system tables from modification by users or administrators in order to prevent modification of the system data from causing server failure or data loss. Server metadata is instead exposed through read-only views called catalog views. Using these views, administrators and developers can gain access to important information about the state of the SQL Server without inadvertently modifying critical system tables. You can use a simple select query to get a comprehensive list of catalog views that SQL Server provides. Over 200 catalog views are included in SQL Server 2005, providing you with quick, secure access to server metadata. We'll take a look at a few of these catalog views here. The SIS certificates view provides information about all the certificates installed on the SQL Server. You can see that one of the certificates is the self-signed certificate that SQL Server is using to encrypt our network traffic. If we installed our own certificate for encryption, it would appear as an entry here as well. Now we'll look at another one of the catalog views available to administrators. The sysdm OS loaded modules view shows you a current list of modules that are loaded into memory on the SQL Server. The DM prefix, which you will find on a number of catalog views, indicates that it is a dynamic management view, providing a snapshot of what is happening on the server right now. Now we have a table list of modules running on the SQL Server at the time the query ran. We can see version information, description, and the physical path to the file. Because this is a dynamic management view, as modules are loaded and unloaded from memory, the results of the query will change. The sys endpoints view returns information about endpoints that have been created on the server. The HTTP endpoint we created earlier appears here. Now we'll take a look at how you can encrypt data within a SQL Server 2005 database. In order to encrypt data within the database, we first have to create a database master key with a password. We'll do that here with the create master key command and specify that the key will be encrypted with a password. Next, we need to create a certificate within the database to be used for encrypting the data with the create certificate command. If you have a number of types of sensitive data within a single database, you can create multiple certificates and then encrypt specific data with the certificate you want. Now that the certificate has been created, we will create a symmetric key named SSN key 01 with the create symmetric key command. As with certificates, you can create multiple keys or use different encryption algorithms as you need. Here, we're specifying AES 256 encryption and using the certificate we created in the previous step to encrypt the key. Now that we've set the database master key, created a certificate and a symmetric key, we're ready to start the process of encrypting the actual data. We'll start by altering one of the database tables, adding a column to store encrypted data. In order to encrypt or decrypt data, we first have to open the key you want to use. Here, we're opening the key we just created and specifying that the key should be decrypted by the certificate we used for encrypting the key. The certificate specified in the decryption by portion of the command must match the certificate you used to encrypt the key or the command will fail. Now, we're ready to perform the encryption. First, we're taking the data from the national ID number column of the table, encrypting it and placing the results into the encrypted national ID number column using the SSN key 01 key. When the query is finished, we can see from the results pane that rows in the table have been updated. Now, let's verify that our new column is really encrypted. As before, to begin the encryption or decryption process, we have to open the key we want to use. Here, the key we open must match the key we use to encrypt the data, or we will not be able to decrypt the data in the column. We'll verify that the encryption worked by comparing our original data from the national ID number column with the decrypted ID number column. In the results, we can see that the encryption was successful. The encryption ID number field contents show you how the national ID number data is stored in the database and how it would be seen by anyone without permission to use the key to decrypt the data. In SQL Server 2005, schemas are containers for database objects like tables and views. Each object within a schema must have a unique name. To learn more about schemas, we'll look at the AdventureWorks database. The AdventureWorks database contains a number of schemas. We'll take a look at the Human Resources schema. The Human Resources schema is owned by the DBO role. Schema ownership can be transferred to users or database roles. In the Permissions window, you can view and assign schema permissions. We'll give a database role some permissions on the schema. We'll add the public database role to the schema. By default, when a user or a database role is added to a schema, it does not receive any permissions on the schema. Even though the public role has been added, the public role will not be able to view or modify any database objects unless we grant specific permissions below. We'll grant the select permission and explicitly deny the delete permission on the schema. Note that an explicit denied takes precedent over any explicit granting of permissions. The extended properties window contains some additional information about the schema. A description of the schema appears in one field, and you can add additional custom information and properties to the schema. Since the Human Resources schema contains tables with sensitive information, we'll cancel here so that we don't give the public role access to this data. If we look at the list of tables in the AdventureWorks database, we can see that there are a number of tables that are contained in the Human Resources schema. For example, the employee table, which contains data on the AdventureWorks employees, is in the Human Resources schema. Now that we've seen how security works at the database level, let's move on to our next agenda item. During this portion of the session, we'll learn about how permissions work in SQL Server 2005. SQL Server 2005 uses granular permissions, which give you a very detailed control over database access. Permissions in SQL Server 2005 can be managed for a number of scopes. Permissions can be granted or denied on SQL servers. You might want to grant the Alter Any Linked Server permission to another database administrator. You can also grant or deny permissions on databases. An application developer might need the Create Table permission to modify an existing database. You can also manage the permissions on schemas, which serve as virtual containers for other database objects. An application developer might need the alter permission to add objects or roles to a schema. Finally, you can grant or deny access to individual database objects. For example, you might want to grant the select permission to a user who needs read-only access to a table to generate a report. Some other concepts regarding permissions are important as well. In talking about permissions, a grantee is someone that can be granted or denied permissions. At the server level, database logins are the only grantees. At the database level, a grantee can refer to database principals such as database users, which can be affiliated with SQL Server logins, or database roles, which may contain database users. A securable is an entity that can have permissions applied to it. This can be a table, a database, a server, or any number of database objects such as views and stored procedures. It's important to keep in mind that the same permission can be set for multiple scopes. For example, the control permission can be granted at both the schema level and the database level independently from one another to allow you very fine control over your data. Also, remember that any explicit deny at any level will always take precedent over any other implicit privileges a grantee may otherwise have on a securable. Now let's move on to the next demonstration. In this demonstration, we'll see how permissions work in SQL Server 2005. The SQL Server 2005 database keeps users and schemas separated for additional security and ease of administration. As we saw earlier, schemas in SQL Server 2005 are containers for database objects such as tables and views. By keeping the users and the schemas separate, you can quickly and easily change user permissions and fine-tune security settings without affecting database applications. We'll learn more about how user-schema separation works right now. First, we'll create a database user named J. Estevez for a corresponding SQL Server login we've already created. We'll also grant J. Estevez the create table permission in the AdventureWorks database. Now, we'll use the execute as command to try and create a table in the database as the J. Estevez user. The create table command fails because although J. Estevez has been granted the create table permission, he does not have ownership permissions on the AdventureWorks database. In order to use his permissions, J. Estevez needs to be assigned to an existing schema or have a new schema created for him. Here, we'll use the revert command to change back to our administrator account, then create a schema for J. Estevez. The authorization argument gives J. Estevez ownership of the schema. Now, we'll try the same create table command as we tried earlier. The command fails again because although J. Estevez now has ownership of a schema, his default schema has not been set. So the create table command still tries to run outside of his schema where he doesn't have permission to create tables. A user can create a table in any schema where he has permission to do so, even if the schema is not his default schema. Here, the create table command succeeds because even though we have set a default schema for just J. Estevez, we specified that table 1 should be created inside the J. Estevez schema container. Users who own multiple schemas can use fully qualified database object names to execute SQL commands in schemas for which they have permission. For convenience, we'll assign J. Estevez a default schema. When using SQL commands with unqualified database object names, the commands will always execute in the user's default schema. As you can see here, now J. Estevez can create tables without having to qualify the names of the tables by specifying the schema name. In the Object Explorer pane, you can see that the tables we just created appear now in the AdventureWorks database. The J. Estevez schema prefix lets us know that the tables are contained within the schema we created for J. Estevez. SQL Server 2005 includes many new permissions in addition to permissions you're already familiar with from earlier versions of SQL Server or from other RDBMS products. For example, we granted the create table permission to a user, and you'll find that SQL Server 2005 uses the familiar grant, deny, and revoke commands to modify permissions. But database administrators have a growing need for control over the permissions they give to users, so that users have permissions to do what they need without having extra permissions that pose security risks. SQL Server 2005 incorporates a new granular permission scheme that allows administrators to give very detailed control over SQL Server installations, based upon the principle of least privilege. Here we'll see what some of these new permissions are and how they work. We'll begin by giving Jay Estevez permission to alter another AdventureWorks database user, Key Bremer. The user T. Bremer has no default schema, so we'll use the execute as command to impersonate J. Estevez in order to assign T. Bremer to the sales schema. As you can see from the results pane, J. Estevez is able to alter T. Bremer's default schema. Note that neither J. Estevez nor T. Bremer need permissions on the sales schema in order to set it as T. Bremer's default schema. Without permissions, though, T. Bremer will be unable to gain access to any objects in the sales schema. If J. Estevez needs to be able to make modifications to the sales schema as a part of routine database application maintenance, we can use the grant the control permission on the sales schema to J. Estevez. The control permission confers owner-like permissions on the user, so that J. Estevez will be able to change the sales schema in any way. Once again, we'll change to the J. Estevez user to grant select, insert, and update permissions on the sales schema to T. Bremer. The with grant option argument can be used to give the user the ability to grant the same permission to other users. In this case, T. Bremer will have the ability to grant select, insert, and update permissions on the sales schema to other database users. Many permissions can also be set through the property pages in other areas of SQL Server Management Studio. We can also look at the property pages to verify the changes we made with SQL commands earlier. Here we can see that T. Bremer's default schema has been set to sales. Now we'll take a look at the sales schema properties. In the properties window for the schema, you can see who has permissions on the schema. J. Estevez has the control permission we granted earlier. Also, we can see that T. Bremer has the insert, select, and update permissions that were granted. You can also use the checkboxes in the bottom pane to grant, revoke, or deny permissions. In SQL Server 2000, users that needed to run SQL traces using the profiler needed SA permissions on the database server. SQL Server 2005 solves this problem by introducing the alter trace permission. Granting a user the alter trace permission allows the user to run SQL traces on the server without having SA permissions. Now that we've seen how to work with permissions, let's move on to our final topic. In this portion of our session, we'll talk about methods you can use to help monitor security on your SQL Server. You can use triggers to help monitor SQL Server databases. SQL Server 2005 introduces DDL triggers, which are triggers that can fire whenever an alteration occurs on a SQL server. The triggers operate at the server or database level, and they are very useful for logging, auditing, and alerting administrators when databases are altered, such as when a table is dropped. While DDL triggers can alert you when a database alteration occurs, the triggers do not contain any information about what the event that caused the trigger to fire was. You can use the event data function to get additional information about why a DDL trigger was fired. The event data function records a number of pieces of information about the event that causes a DDL trigger to fire, including the type of event, the SPID of the connection that caused the event, the login and username of the user who executed the statement, and the type of event. All the information returned by the event data function is in XML format so that it can be easily viewed and used by administrators. Now we'll take a closer look at triggers. Now we'll see how DDL triggers work. Here we have a database with a table called names. We want to create a DDL trigger to fire if the names table is dropped. First, we create a table called DDL log for the trigger to log to. Next, we use the create trigger command to create a trigger on the database. The trigger inserts a record into the DDL log table if the names table is dropped. When we run the drop table command, the names table is dropped from the database. This causes the trigger to fire and insert a record into the DDL log table. In the next demonstration, we'll see this feature in action. In this demonstration, you'll see how to monitor and maintain security on your SQL Server. The dedicated administrator connection feature, when enabled, creates a special connection to a SQL Server for administrator use. An administrator can make a connection through DAC even when a SQL Server is not responding to regular network connections, giving you a way to monitor and troubleshoot problems when other connection methods are unavailable. You can make a connection through DAC using the SQL Server Management Studio or through the SQL Command command line utility. We'll look at how to make a connection with SQL Command. SQL Command is the new command line tool for SQL Server 2005 and offers a number of different options. For example, the E flag instructs SQL Command to use a trusted connection with the current credentials for authentication. And the Q flag can be used to send a query to the server and then exit. The output from the query will appear in the command prompt window. To use the dedicated administrator connection, we need to add the A flag to the command line, specifying that we are connecting to the DAC port. Once SQL Command connects to the dedicated administrator connection, it will run the query, print out a list of databases on the server, and then exit. We can see from the output that we were successfully able to connect to the SQL Server through the dedicated administrator connection. Note that the dedicated administrator connection feature must be specifically enabled on the surface area configuration tool. We'll try and use DAC to connect to SID SQL 01, which has DAC disabled. We can see from the error message that the server refused the request to connect over the dedicated administrator connection port. One of the most important new features for monitoring security in SQL Server 2005 is DDL triggers. DDL triggers allow you to perform a number of actions when an attempt is made to gain access to or modify a database. You can be alerted when logins occur, when database is altered, or when an attempt is made to alter the structure of the database. We'll look at a few ways you can use this to help secure your SQL Server 2005 databases. Here, we're going to create a trigger on the AdventureWorks database called Safety. This trigger will fire when someone attempts to drop a table in the database. the trigger will issue a warning message to the user, then roll back the transaction to prevent the table from being dropped. Now, we'll try to drop a table from the database. The AWBuild version table has no foreign key constraints that would otherwise prevent it from being dropped. But when we run the drop table statement, the trigger fires, warns us that we must first disable the trigger in order to drop tables, then rolls back the transaction so that the table remains in place. If we need to drop tables from the AdventureWorks database, we must first drop the safety trigger using the drop trigger command. Once the trigger is dropped, we could use the drop table command successfully. There may be times when, instead of preventing database modifications, that you simply want to log the changes that were made. We'll look at how DDL triggers can do that as well. We'll create a table that a DDL trigger can log events to. Next, we'll create another table to use for testing the trigger. Now we'll create the trigger. This trigger fires when an alter table command is run on the AdventureWorks database. The trigger will allow the alter table command to complete, but will insert a row into the table we created in step 1. Now, we'll add a column to the test table with an alter table command. This should cause the trigger to fire. When we look at the DDL audit table we created in step 1, we can see that the trigger fired as planned and inserted a new row into the table. In the previous example, we used a DDL trigger to let us know that a table was altered, and the trigger added a message to a table. While that message is useful, it doesn't tell us much about the specific SQL command that caused the trigger to fire. SQL Server 2005 provides a function called EventData that can be used to provide specific information about SQL events. First, we'll create a new table on AdventureWorks that has fields for holding information returned from the event data function, such as the time, user, event type, and the full SQL statement that caused the trigger to fire. Next, we'll modify the trigger to write information from the event data function into the table we just created. Note that the event data function returns data in XML format for easy use. Now, we'll add another new column to the AW trigger test table. The alter table command we use here should cause the trigger to fire again. Let's look in the DDL event table now. We can see from the entry that the trigger fired when we altered the AW trigger test table. Now, instead of having a standard message alerting us to a table modification, we can see that when the trigger was fired, the user that caused it to fire, the type of DDL event that caused it to fire, and the full text of the SQL statement that caused it to fire. With this kind of information, we have a very quick, precise way to protect databases and get specific information about database alterations. This concludes our session. Let's review what we've covered. As you've seen today, SQL Server 2005 is designed to be secure by default, enabling the minimum set of services and features you need so that you can reduce the exposure of your enterprise data. SQL Server 2005 security is multifaceted, working with your Active Directory security policies and bringing security at the SQL Server and database levels to help you easily choose and manage the security of your SQL servers throughout the organization. Granular permissions and the new user schema separation model help you finely tune your database security policy, ensuring that users can get the data they need without having more permissions than they need. To get more information on the products and technologies we have covered today, there are some online resources available that can help. For the most comprehensive technical information on Microsoft products, visit the main TechNet website at www.microsoft.com/technet. Additionally, visit www.microsoft.com/technet/SQL05 for more information on books, courses, certifications, and other community resources that related directly to this particular session. There are a number of other resources that are available from Microsoft. Introducing Microsoft SQL Server 2005 for Developers is a book that introduces new programmability and data management features for database developers. Another book is Microsoft SQL Server 2005 Administrator's Pocket Consultant. It's a practical pocket reference that gives you details for performing a variety of administrative tasks. Microsoft SQL Server 2005 Programming Setup Step-by-Step teaches you how to design, build, deploy, and maintain SQL Server 2005 databases with the new database development and security features. There's also a number of good books from other publishers. Microsoft SQL Server 2005 New Features introduces new features in database administration, database development, and business intelligence features in SQL Server 2005. Microsoft SQL Server 2005 Changing the Paradigm discusses the changes, new concepts, and features of SQL Server 2005. A first look at SQL Server 2005 for developers describes new programmability features to help you use the new security and performance tools and T-SQL enhancements. Microsoft also has instructor-led courses if you prefer the classroom-style environment. Microsoft Learning develops courseware called Microsoft Official Curriculum, or MOC, which includes e-learning, MS Pressbooks, workshops, clinics, and Microsoft Skills Assessment. MOC is offered in instructor-led environments. It offers comprehensive training courses for IT professionals, support, and implements solutions using Microsoft products and technologies. The courses that best support this session are Updating Your Database Administration Skills to SQL Server 2005, which is available now, and Updating Your Database Development Skills to SQL Server 2005, which is also available now. For more information, please visit www.microsoft.com/learning. There's also an assessment program available that can help you test your knowledge. Microsoft Skills Assessment is a free online learning tool. It's an easy way for IT professionals to check their skills. You can quickly check your skills for implementing or managing Microsoft products or business solutions. Just take a short 30-question assessment and see how well you know your stuff. The skills assessment includes a personalized learning plan, which includes links to Microsoft official curriculum, specific TechNet articles, Microsoft Pressbooks, and other Microsoft learning content. There's also a way to measure how well you did compared with others who took the same assessment. Microsoft Skills Assessment is an expanding learning platform. Available now are assessments for Windows Server 2003, including security and patch management, Exchange Server 2003, Windows Storage Server, Office 2003, and VisualStudio.net. If you want to take your skills assessment to the next level, a number of certification programs are available. In the highly competitive IT job market, how can you differentiate yourself from the next candidate? The Microsoft Certification Program provides that edge. Earning a specific accreditation provides objective validation of the ability to successfully perform critical IT functions. Embraced by industry professionals worldwide, Microsoft Certification remains one of the most effective ways to reach long-term career goals and is a surefire way for companies to develop and retain valuable IT staff. There are a number of accreditations available, starting with the basic Microsoft Certified Professional, or MCP. You can choose to go and become a fully certified System Administrator, or MSCA, or System Engineer, MCSE, or a Desktop Specialist, MCDST. Away from the infrastructure side, the MCDBA certification covers the SQL Server products. For more information about the certification program, visit www.microsoft.com/learning/MCP. This session was brought to you by TechNet. TechNet has gone through some changes recently, which I'm sure you'll find interesting to hear about. To help explain this in more detail, I'd like to introduce Holly Dias, Senior Marketing Manager for TechNet.
Many of you may be familiar with TechNet events and the TechNet website, but have you ever realized the benefits of being a TechNet Plus subscriber? A TechNet Plus subscription is the most convenient and reliable resource for IT professionals evaluating, managing, and supporting Microsoft technologies. With a TechNet Plus subscription, you can evaluate Microsoft software without time limits. This benefit allows you to try products at your own pace and make informed decisions without worrying about the software expiring. TechNet Plus evaluation software includes the latest Microsoft operating systems, server applications, and Office products. With TechNet Plus, you can also save time resolving technical issues. TechNet Plus subscriptions include a range of support options, including the complete Microsoft knowledge base delivered each month on portable media, and two complimentary professional support incidents to address your technical roadblocks. TechNet Plus offers centralized access to current, authoritative technical guidance, software, and support resources from Microsoft. IT professionals around the world rely on TechNet Plus every day to help them build their technical expertise and be successful in implementing Microsoft solutions. For details, visit www.microsoft.com/TechNet/subscriptions. On the subject of TechNet resources, the new TechNet support page outlines all the support resources available for you. The enhanced TechNet troubleshooting and support page outlines all the ways IT professionals can get support assistance from Microsoft. From free online support options to subscription-based support, you'll find all your Microsoft support resources in one location at www.microsoft.com/TechNet/support. TechNet also provides a number of community resources. There are a number of free resources available on TechNet. You can attend a regular chat with members of product groups or technology specialists from Microsoft, or you can attend a webcast where you can see sessions like the one you've just watched, but presented live and with the ability to ask questions as you go. You can also read or post questions in public news groups. The TechNet newsgroup page lists the available groups and provides an interface from which you can read and post messages. TechNet Plus subscribers can use these groups to post their technical questions, and because they are subscribers, are guaranteed a response to any technical questions by next business day from community experts or Microsoft support professionals. The main community site provides a comprehensive list of resources available, more than we can ever cover on this slide. Plus, the page has some dynamic features with continually updated content. The events page provides dates and details where you can attend a TechNet event live. These events take place around the world and provide the opportunity for you to talk with Microsoft specialists face-to-face. And finally, TechNet columns provide a variety of topics written by industry authors. Thank you very much for listening to this session.